From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Wednesday, the 22nd of April, Earth Day 2009. A congressional inquiry reveals that Chinese Communist regime methods were used to interrogate detainees in U.S. custody. On Earth Day, we'll go to Colombia, where an innovative car maker is revealing a new electric hybrid for under $10,000. And we'll hear from South Africa, where votes are being counted to decide whether the ruling party will hold on to its absolute majority. I'm Aura Abogado. Those stories after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Supreme Court today began its evaluation of a case that could redefine civil rights law in the workplace. The case brings up questions of race and employment testing in a Connecticut fire department. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
In 2003, the New Haven Fire Department gave a test to its firefighters for promotions to captain and lieutenant positions. When the results came back, only one Hispanic and no black candidates were found to be eligible for promotion. Under attacks that the test was racially biased, the city of New Haven held a series of 5 hearings. They decided that the exam was flawed and scrapped the results. Karen Torrey, the lawyer for the white firefighters, says there was nothing wrong with the test and that the city's decision amounted to reverse discrimination. Meanwhile, spokespeople in support of the decision say testing often reduces diversity in the workplace. They advocate improving tests to make them fairer and more applicable to the job's particular skill set. The Supreme Court will determine if the city was legally correct in throwing out the original test results. This is the second of 4 cases on race that the court will hear in the coming weeks. It will likely reach a decision by this summer. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The FBI has continued its implication of U.S.-based activists as terrorists. The Bureau's newest most wanted terror suspects list includes Daniel Andreas San Diego, an animal rights activist accused of setting off pipe bombs at 2 corporations connected to animal testing. The California man is the first non-Islamist suspect to be added to the list. Carrboro, North Carolina has become the second community in the country to adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights as guiding principles. From the Tri-Cities region, Linda Marie Tarasi has the story.
With a population just over 16,000, Carrboro, North Carolina is known as one of the most progressive communities in the South. Now, Carrboro, second to Washington, D.C., became one of the first communities to take a stand for human rights. Judith Blau is director of the Human Rights Center of Chapel Hill in Carrboro, responsible for petitioning Carrboro's Board of Aldermen to adopt the declaration, commonly referred to as UDHR.
The Universal Declaration was proclaimed by the General Assembly of the United Nations in 1948. The committee that drafted it was chaired by Eleanor Roosevelt. She said that these international agreements are essential for peace in the world, but it needs to be embodied in local communities and cities. That's where they take hold.
The declaration includes 30 articles that address everything from torture, religion, marriage, and voting, and is said to be the most translated document in the world. Linda Marie Tarasi, FSRN.
The Tittabawassee and Saginaw Rivers in Michigan have signs posted along their banks saying fish consumption and soil and river contamination advisories in effect. The rivers are known to be contaminated with toxic substances, including dioxin. But according to the Michigan Messenger, organizers of this weekend's walleye fishing festival plan to donate the fish caught during the event to a local food bank. Many environmentalists want the region classified as a Superfund site. Taliban forces controlling Pakistan's Swat Valley are pushing out into the surrounding regions, and they have established a base within 60 miles of the country's capital, Islamabad. These emboldened territory claims come on the heels of a peace deal between the Taliban and the Pakistani government. Today, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said Pakistan was a mortal threat to U.S. and world security. Bids for unified Palestinian leadership were further strained today by arrests in the West Bank. According to Israel's Ynet News, Hamas claims Fatah has been detaining their operatives and shaving off their beards. Unity talks are scheduled to resume in 2 weeks. Also today, Israeli authorities demolished another Palestinian home in East Jerusalem, and a group of Norwegian lawyers has accused 10 Israelis of war crimes for their actions during the conflicts in Gaza. A recent law in Norway allows non-Norwegians to face charges associated with genocide and war crimes. Much of the top Israeli leadership has been implicated in the complaint. In other news from the region, the fourth Belain Conference of Nonviolent Resistance opened less than a week after an Israeli tear gas canister killed a protester in the town. Ghassan Benoura of IMEMC.org reports.
Local and international protesters in the small West Bank village of Belain have been conducting weekly nonviolent demonstrations against the Israeli wall for 4 years. Iyad Burnat is an organizer of the conference and the head of the village committee against the wall and settlements.
150 people from different parts of the world took part in the conference today. Our objective is to support and expand nonviolent popular resistance everywhere.
Delegates will discuss ways to promote nonviolent resistance in the region and to formulate a network of support worldwide. The conference will end on Friday with a weekly nonviolent protest against the wall. Ghassan Barnoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
A congressional report details widespread, coordinated, and deliberate approval of harsh interrogation techniques used on detainees in U.S. custody from the highest ranks of the Bush administration. The inquiry reveals that some of the techniques were based on methods the Chinese Communist regime used during the Korean War. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the Department of Justice has been asked to investigate.
Just 3 months after September 11th, the Defense Department began consulting with its trainers who teach service members how to resist torture. Those trainers obtained severe interrogation tactics used by the Chinese against Korean prisoners. They include sleep deprivation, slapping, fear, humiliation, and waterboarding. This was the beginning of widespread discussions among top officials within the Defense Department, the Department of Justice, the National Security Agency, even up to the President and the Vice President on the use of interrogation tactics the Geneva Convention deemed illegal. Democratic Senator Carl Levin, chair of the Armed Services Committee, which authored the report, says it connects the dots.
What people saw at Abu Ghraib was not just the random acts of some people who are acting on their own.
The administration has blamed Abu Ghraib and accusations of torture on, quote, a few bad apples. But this report shows deliberate discussions and policy formations on interrogation tactics at the Defense Department and the CIA. It shows that President Bush signed a memo justifying harsh tactics. The report quotes the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, was involved in multiple discussions, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld approved the tactics for detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan, and Iraq. The Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel provided the legal justification.
I think that the legal opinions were abominable, that said that these tactics were legal, including waterboarding.
The 200-page unclassified report took 1.5 years to compile. Senator Levin recommends the Justice Department open an investigation. He did not rule out implicating Vice President Cheney and President Bush.
What I have called for is for the Justice Department to select a few outside independent people to give recommendations as to whether anybody should be prosecuted.
Top Republican on the committee and torture survivor John McCain says the report reveals abuses, but he says the Bush administration should not be investigated or prosecuted.
We need to get this behind us and we need to move forward.
When Bush administration officials were making decisions to use those interrogation tactics, the U.S. law at the time said any violations of the Geneva Conventions constituted a war crime. To sidestep that law, in 2002, President Bush signed a memo that said the Geneva Conventions did not apply to the Taliban or al-Qaeda. Also in 2002, the Justice Department issued far-fetching definitions of torture. That torture amounts to organ failure and significant psychological harm for an extended amount of time. With the insistence of the Bush administration, Congress attempted to define torture in 2005 and then again in 2006 in the Military Commissions Act. It narrowly defined torture, similar to that of the Justice Department's extreme interpretation. Caroline Fredrickson is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
It's time that there was the attention devoted to this that have been devoted to a variety of scandals in our history.
For the first time yesterday, President Obama suggested the Justice Department or an independent commission investigate. Vice President Cheney continues to defend interrogations. On Fox News, he says all the memos should be released and a picture of necessity would be painted, he says. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
South African voters headed to the polls today to elect local and national leaders. Jacob Zuma, the controversial but popular presidential candidate from the ruling African National Congress Party, will likely take the ticket. The biggest question now remains whether the party will hold on to its absolute majority in parliament. Davison Makanga reports from Cape Town.
I think that women's matters should be addressed in more detail. I don't think that there's enough issues dealt with, like, for example, rape and those things. I think that that should be given more priority, things like that.
The government doesn't really come down to the ground and see if do we get enough services or good services from the service providers. We don't. Especially at clinic, local clinics, we don't. You go there, you need help. Sometimes you don't get it, sometimes you get it.
Some of the voters in South Africa's Western Cape province voicing their concerns just before casting the ballot in Wednesday's national elections. The poll is the country's fourth since the official end of apartheid in 1994. According to the Independent Electoral Commission, some 23 million people are registered to vote. Prominent politicians also voted, and outgoing President Halema Motlanthe urged registered voters to exercise their right.
This is an opportunity. It's very, very important. Everyone must utilize it. Everyone who participates in this election strengthens our democracy.
Leader of opposition party Democratic Alliance, Helen Zille, was optimistic after voting in the coastal seat of Cape Town. Zille's party launched a fierce campaign against the ruling African National Congress, accusing it of corruption and bad governance.
It always feels good to vote. It always feels good to take responsibility for building the future, and we're building one nation with one future.
The man tipped to be the country's next president, Jacob Zuma, cast his ballot in his home area of Inkandla. The African National Congress leader's popularity increased after state prosecutors dropped corruption charges, citing political interference. With Zuma's victory seemingly inevitable, analysts say the challenge will be whether his party will garner an outright two-thirds majority. This in the wake of a breakaway party, Congress of the People, COPE, that was formed last December. Political commentator Eusebius Makeza says even though COPE is not a threat to ANC, it might grab important votes that can curtail ANC from getting a controlling parliamentary majority.
What's exciting about COPE is that it is the possibility of a black-led official opposition. I think they will be hard-pressed to actually be able to beat the DA, but nonetheless, what's significant is that we might begin to slowly now really break out of the racial cleavages of our opposition politics by having a black-led opposition.
Wednesday's largely well-managed exercise had its own glitches. A presiding officer was arrested at a polling station in the hotly contested province of KwaZulu-Natal for allegedly stuffing a ballot box with 100 marked ballot papers. The officer has been arrested and charged with electoral fraud. However, leader of the party in question, Mangosuthu Buthelezi of the Inkatha Freedom Party, dismissed allegations against his party's involvement. He told the state broadcaster this afternoon that it was a ploy by political rivals bent on destabilizing his party. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission expects full results of the elections on Saturday. Tefson Makanga, FSRN, Cape Town, South Africa.
An internal investigation by the Israeli military indicates Israel did not violate international law during its recent war on Gaza. The report admits that mistakes took place, including the killing of 21 people when a home was erroneously targeted, but it adds that such mistakes are not avoidable, particularly because Hamas chose to fight from within the civilian population. Israel's investigation also yielded that it used white phosphorus in a legal manner. This despite evidence that indicates the military used the chemical in areas with dense civilian populations. Between 1,100 and 1,400 Palestinians were killed as a result of Israel's attack, and between 33% to 66% of those killed were civilians. 10 Israeli soldiers also died, and 3 Israeli civilians were killed from rocket assaults. Israel's internal investigation contradicts the United Nations, Human Rights Watch, and other groups that say Israel violated international law during its incursion. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, people with advanced health problems who need treatment from specialists outside of the territory can't leave without first getting permission. The Hamas-run health ministry has now taken over the coordination office for those referrals. As FSRN's Rami Al-Magari reports, hundreds of patients who are awaiting treatment at hospitals outside of Gaza could be affected.
In the heart of Gaza City, families gather every day in front of the office for referring patients to hospitals outside of Gaza. They are hoping to get approval to travel for family members that need urgent medical care at hospitals outside Gaza. But many go back home empty-handed. Thuraya Asfour is one of these Gazans. She is an elderly mother with a 30-year-old son named Samir. He needs a valve installed in his heart, but he has to be referred outside of Gaza to get his surgery. Thuraya travels from southern Gaza to Gaza City almost once a week in the hope she gets the needed papers.
No one has assured us yet. We are just seeking the help of God. What can we do? Each party has its own allegations. One is speaking for Hamas, the other is speaking for Fatah. Well, we are lost between the two sides. The patient is lost between both. I have nothing more to say. My heart has had enough, my son.
In March, the Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza seized control of the coordination office for referral to hospitals outside of Gaza. This office used to be administered by Ramallah government-linked officers who used to coordinate and facilitate entry of patients to the West Bank, Israel, or Egypt. Afasaran asked Hamas's Deputy Minister of Health, Mr. Hassan Khalaf, what reasons led to the seizure of the office. Mr. Khalaf explained,
"We knew the corruption of that administration, and we knew the political aspect, and we knew the delayment and catastrophes of that work. We tried last September to take over, and at that time, the international organization like ICRC, WHO, and the others came to us, and they beg us to reverse our decision."
The decision had helped delay travel of about 800 patients, the monthly average number of people getting permits for treatment at hospitals in the West Bank and Israel. Currently, the World Health Organization is following up on the issue and helping urgent cases get access to health services outside of Gaza. Mahmoud Dahir is a spokesperson for the WHO in Gaza.
Since the 22nd of March and then today, there have been some patients who are in very critical conditions could get out with the support of international organizations and Israeli organizations. In this case, about 53 patients were supported by these organizations. We are referring to these organizations in order to help effectively the coordination with the Israeli authorities and seeking some funds to cover their care in outside Gaza Strip.
On Saturday, Egyptian authorities reopened the Rafah crossing terminal in southern Gaza for a couple of days, allowing access for several hundred people, including some Palestinian patients and many other travelers. However, many say this is not enough to relieve the backlog of people waiting for urgent care. Since June 2007, both Fatah and Hamas have been at loggerheads after Hamas seized control of Gaza and ousted Fatah allied forces from the region. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah formed a caretaker government in Ramallah and outlawed the Islamist Hamas party. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The fifth summit of the Americas held last week in Trinidad and Tobago marked the beginning of a new relationship between the U.S. and Latin America. Obama charmed regional leaders and appears to have listened to longstanding demands, including the call to end the 47-year-old U.S. trade embargo on Cuba. Venezuela's Hugo Chavez announced his country will send back its ambassador to Washington. FSRN's Jorge Garretón is in Chile, where some South American analysts are weighing in on how things might move forward in the hemisphere.
President Barack Obama ushered a new era of relations with Latin America when he told regional leaders that he wants an equal partnership with them. That sounded like a major policy departure from what the continent was used to. Throughout the two-day summit, the unresolved Cuba blockade was front and center. Latin American leaders took turns to convey to Obama how the 47-year-old trade blockade with Cuba must go first. Argentine President Cristina Fernandez said the U.S. blockade of the island is absurd and must end soon. And Brazil's Lula told Obama to ensure Cuba's participation at the next hemisphere summit. At a UNASUR bilateral meeting with Obama, Bolivian President Evo Morales complained about how the U.S. Embassy in La Paz intruded blatantly in Bolivia's political affairs. The summit ended with an air of hope, but some are skeptical. International political analyst Raul Sor.
In the Bolivian case, you can understand that Morales is rather upset having a plot against his life having been discovered. I mean, three foreign mercenaries were killed in Santa Cruz. This whole episode is far from being clear yet, but something went on there, and we wait for more news from that. But, I mean, obviously, this has created a very heavy atmosphere in Bolivia, and Morales is expressing that.
As Bolivia waits for Obama's words to turn to deeds in bilateral relations, President Morales will remain skeptical of the real intentions of the U.S. in Bolivia. The U.S. drug policy toward Latin America may also change, but that is mainly with Colombia and its president. Colombian President Uribe wants to curb the U.S. involvement, and his government may forego $4 billion in military aid for Plan Colombia. But Colombia may have to take over the U.S. Air Force Drug Interdiction Operating Base. The current base is located in Manta, Ecuador. The U.S. has to leave it by November because the lease expired. University of Chile political science professor Guillermo Holzman.
The U.S. has the Manta issue high on its agenda for the past few years. It has raised the issue in bilateral meetings, but Obama did not have any bilateral meetings at this summit, so any talks with local leaders were set aside. The U.S. has a number of options in Colombia, Paraguay has removed itself, and Peru is also interested. But all indications are Colombia in the end. It will take the Air Force space despite other future options.
An option could be the departure of the airbase from the region because of a change of U.S. policy towards cocaine trafficking, in which it would involve the countries most affected by the illegal trade to work jointly in interdiction. Change is coming, but as Bolivia's Morales said, until words turn to deeds, the region shall keep a vigilant eye. Jorge Garretón, FSRN, Santiago.
Today marks the 39th annual Earth Day in the United States, and President Obama is using the occasion to tell people that renewable energy is vital to the nation's prosperity. The president presented an Earth Day speech at a factory that produces wind energy towers, connecting clean energy to the economy.
The nation that leads the world in creating new energy sources will be the nation that leads the 21st century global economy. America can be that nation. America must be that nation.
Meanwhile, other nations around the world are already moving forward on new and green technologies, and Colombia is now the latest to enter the green car market. The Salamandra, or salamander, is expected to hit South America's roads in the middle of this year. Manuel Rueda reports from Bogota.
Here's my key, philosophy. A freak like me just needs infinity.
Engineers in the city of Bucaramanga recently presented the Salamandra Lexion, a two-seater that's about the size of Mr. Bean's Mini Cooper. It's got a curvy and compact frame that brings back memories of the Volkswagen Beetle, but this car has three wheels, and it's powered by an engine that works mostly with electricity and small amounts of gasoline. William Merca is the designer. He's planning to take the Salamandra beyond Colombia's borders.
You have countries like Holland that want 90% of their vehicles to be electric by 2030. Spain has announced it wants 1 million hybrids on its street by 2014. Around the world, companies and people are taking on the obligation to stop polluting and to preserve the environment.
Car companies across the globe are receiving incentives to develop green cars. The US and European countries currently offer tax deductions to consumers and low-interest loans to producers. And despite the financial crisis, major manufacturers like Chrysler and General Motors are planning to launch their own hybrids within the next 2 years. In the US, smaller startup companies are also vying for a slice of the green car market. Henrik Fisker heads the California-based Fisker Automotive. His company recently secured an $85 million investment to develop the Fisker Karma. Last week, Fisker promoted his invention at a car show in Monaco.
The first 50 miles you drive is pure electric, so emission-free. And after 50 miles, a small gasoline engine turns a generator. And then you can drive for another 250 miles. So if you plug it in at home every night, like a cell phone, if you drive less than 50 miles a day, you don't use any gas.
The Karma should hit America's roads by early 2010. And it will sell for about $80,000. Despite the high price tag, Fisker says it's a good deal.
You can, of course, argue that it's expensive, but you have to imagine that we sell this car as a luxury car, so you buy this instead of an $80,000 Mercedes or BMW. The only difference is with our car, you have a plug-in hybrid, and you can get over 100 miles per gallon, but you still have the performance of a V8. We have 400 horsepower. You can go 125 miles an hour.
Fisker says he's targeting the luxury market because technology is still too costly to develop these vehicles for a cheaper price. But Salamandra's investors have said they will sell their plug-in hybrid for under $10,000. Carlos González runs the Salamandra franchise in Spain.
We're not going to spend any money on publicity, and our car will cost five times less than any other vehicle with its characteristics. There won't be any competition. I think people will take these off our hands.
The Salamandra Lexion doesn't have a state-of-the-art solar panel roof like the Fisker Karma, and it can only go a maximum of 40 miles per hour. Salamandra manager William Mercay says he chose to go for these modest features in order to keep prices low. The idea, he says, is not only to be environmentally responsible, but also to help many Colombians to achieve their dream of buying their first car. Mercay also plans to release more elaborate and costly versions of the Salamandra. He's designed a vehicle that will carry 5 passengers and reach speeds of up to 62 miles per hour. He also plans to fit his cars with engines that run with compressed air. And he's working on a Salamandra that will be able to run on water and land, just like the amphibian the car took its name from. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bucaramanga, Colombia.
And you can see pictures of this car, the Salamandra, on our website, fsrn.org. And that will wrap it up for today's newscast. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.